91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour begins with the literary scene and the Big Read program of the National Endowment for the Arts. March is National Reading Awareness Month, so we'll learn more about the many community events of the Big Read Miami with acclaimed author Edwige Jantika and writer Lisette Mendez of the Miami International Book Fair. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper and more. Thursday brings chef, author, and syndicated columnist Lindy Gassenheimer with a discussion about what's most important to great cooking: quality groceries. On hand is supermarket guru Phil Lempert, who's the expert in smart shopping and healthy eating. He also gives thorough product reviews of the new items at the Mega Mart. Topical Currents up next after the news. And welcome back to Thursday's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. This hour begins with a visit by acclaimed author Edwige Jantika, whose award-winning memoir, Brother, I'm Dying, is being celebrated by the community's shared reading program, The Big Read Miami.
The book is a stirring family memoir and a winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award, and was also nominated for the National Book Award. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome, Edwige.
And also with us by phone is writer Lisette Mendez, a principal organizer of the Miami Book Fair. Thank you for being here, Lisette.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome, Lisette. Edwige, it's such a pleasure to have you on Topical Currents, finally, because I don't think you've ever been on Topical Currents.
No, I haven't had the pleasure, but I listen plenty.
It's hard to believe.
Okay. Yeah, I know. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
What an honor having your memoir being chosen for the Big Read Miami. It's a beautiful work. I mean, a very haunting and beautiful work. What was your reaction when you heard the news?
Well, I was extremely honored. And also the fact, because I live in this community, I think it made it really extra special when Lisette told me that this book was going to be chosen for the Big Read. But I also think it's the ties to the community are very strong in the book. A lot of it takes place here. And I think there are a lot of families that are going through some of the same experiences with their immigration encounters, the immigration experience that, as my family does in the book. So it's very local. It's very special to me, the fact that this community is reading this particular book.
How difficult was it for you to write, or how different was it for you to write a memoir instead of fiction?
Well, I tend to call this book instead of a memoir, a we-moir.
A we-moir.
Yeah,
right.
Because it's really a group effort, and I never intended to write a memoir. It was not something I thought I would do. But in 2004, I had this really terrible and yet wonderful year when my father was dying of pulmonary fibrosis. My uncle died in immigration custody here at the Chrome Detention Center after escaping trouble in Haiti. And my daughter, Mira, was born all that year. And so as I was wrapping up this year, I thought, you know, I started writing really for myself, you know, for solace, and it became this book.
You'll probably be expecting a lot of young readers to pick up this book for the first time. What would you expect them to get out of it?
Well, I hope they hear echoes of their stories, because I'm a voracious reader still, but I had a lot more time to read when I was younger. And it was always special when you recognize a bit of your story and something that is published and something that others are reading. So I hope they will see a little bit of themselves, because we have a very high number of immigrant families, mixed status families here in South Florida, and that they also get a glimpse at some of the history of Haiti and some of the troubles that we've had, and the reason that in many cases some of our families are here.
And you've written five books for younger readers, so it kind of is in your power alley there.
Yeah, and I always see those as being connected. I think particularly for young readers, this is when we fall in love with reading. You know, often we're forced to read in school, but then sometimes there's one book that transforms us. It would be my honor if my book was among those books. But I really think it's a powerful time to be exposed to a certain kind of literature when we're young, it really has an impact.
Before we bring in Lisette, I was wondering, because you wanted to be a writer from a very young age, did you use reading and writing to comfort yourself? Because those were tumultuous times, with your parents gone and you being raised by your uncle. And was it something that you turned to?
Yeah, well, my parents left Haiti when my father when I was two, my mother when I was four, and I was raised by my aunt and uncle, the uncle who is one of the people focused on the book. And I was told stories. That was my primary exposure to storytelling. And then whenever I could come across a book, I did read. And I think that's also why I value books. And I'm still one of those people, like when I go to the doctor's office with my daughter, I still want to take the free book because it was such a valuable gift to me when I was a child to have a book in my hand, to have a book that is mine. And so whenever I've had that opportunity, it's definitely a solace to find myself in within a story and to lose yourself in
a
story.
Right.
What was it in your early days that prompted you to begin writing at age 9 and in Creole?
Well, I just loved stories. I love stories, and my brothers and I, I have a cousin who I grew up with in Haiti. We used to, they tried to make comic books, and I would write the stories, and they would try to draw the pictures. And I think it was just the love of stories and a really intense desire that still carries on in me today to want to share something, you know, within yourself, to connect in that way through a story.
Well, let's bring in writer Lisette Mendez now. Lisette is one of the principal organizers of the Miami Book Fair. Welcome to you, Lisette.
Thank you. Thank you for having
me. Again, why did you choose Edwige's book for the Big Read Miami?
Oh, so many reasons. I think primarily I've always been in love with Edwige's writing. I have lived personally very, very similar experiences, though obviously different. I came here in the Mariel boat lift, and so many of my friends and families are immigrants and have had experiences that are similar to some of the ones that Edwige has been writing about, and especially this particular book. So that was definitely an impetus. I think also I've been, all of us here at the Miami Book Fair have been working to expand the amount of programming that we do that focuses on the Haitian community in Miami. Miami is very much very Haitian. There's so many people in South Florida in general that have the kinds of stories that Edwige has been writing about. And I think that it's important for all of us to know and learn more about it. I've been working with Book Fair for about 10 years, and one of the things that I have always loved about what we do, and that was also very important to me growing up, was being able to make these stories, to give these stories a platform, you know, through all of the books that we present, not just during the 8-day festival, but throughout the year. You know, it sounds a little bit like a cliche, but bridging our communities, all of the different communities that are part of Miami, whether it's the Haitian American community or the Cuban American or other Latin American communities, the other Caribbean communities, African American communities, and everyone that lives here, learning about each other's lives and each other's stories through books such as Brother, I'm Dying, I think it can help us become more united. You know, this is a particularly contentious election year, you know, when it comes to issues of immigration, issues of differences, you know, in whether they're differences in culture or race or lifestyle or, you know, identity of any kind. And, you know, for me, when choosing this book, that was a primary goal. How do we use the power of stories, which really is the way that we define ourselves as human? You know, how do we use the power of stories to bridge that kind of distrust, you know, to bridge that kind of fear of the other? And so far, it's going really well. We're having some really great conversations about what life in Haiti is like, what life in Miami for Haitian Americans is like. How is that? How are those experiences, like Adouja's experiences, her family's experiences, how are they very similar to the experiences of others that have come to live in the U.S., that have come to live in Miami, and how we can make things better? I mean, that's the whole idea in the end.
That's so well put. Thank you for saying all that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Could you just explain what the relationship is between the Big Read and the Miami Book Fair?
Yeah, of course. So Miami Book Fair, as many of your listeners probably know, is an eight-day festival that takes place here at Miami-Dade College. It's been part of Miami-Dade College for 32 years. This is going to be our 33rd year in November. And so most people know about the 8 days, the 700 authors, you know, and all of the other programming that we do. But we also have been doing year-round programs that are mainly literary, but also span other kinds of, tie into other disciplines, whether it's art or photography or music or theater, throughout the year. We've been doing it for about 10, 11 years now in a very systematic way. For a while, we were known as the Center for Writing and Literature at Miami-Dade College, but it started getting confusing, so many organizations, that we just decided to go with Miami Book Fair and present all year round the different programs that we do as Miami Book Fair. So the Big Read is something we've done for about 10 years now. We also have a lot of creative writing workshops. We have other kinds of we do programming during National Poetry Month. Next month we'll have a few programs, including a mashup of Afro-Caribbean poetry and Indian dance. Just a lot of programs for kids. We give away books for children to the tune of about 160,000 books a year in different community centers throughout the city. So we're the same team, the same people, and we just bring more literature to the community as often as we can.
Well, we're speaking with writer Lisette Mendez. She's one of the principal organizers of the Miami Book Fair. Also with us, Edwige Dantica. She's an award-winning author, novels, short stories, nonfiction. Born in Port-au-Prince, but she's lived in the U.S. since the age of 12. We're talking about her book and the Big Read Miami, her book, Brother, I'm Dying. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. We're speaking with award-winning author Edwige Dantica. Her book, Brother, I'm Dying, it's a memoir. It was the 2008 winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Autobiography, a finalist for the National Book Award. And we're also with writer Lisette Mendez, who's one of the principal organizers of the Miami Book Fair and chose Brother, I'm Dying as the book for Big Read Miami. Big Read Miami is a national program that's been going on for many years now, I think almost 10 years, and it's in several communities in the United States.
Edwige, you've had rather a meteoric career the past decade or so. You had a MacArthur Genius Grant. You've had honorary degrees from Yale, Smith College, a Langston Hughes Medal. You must be very proud of that, and that you've had such a big effect on the literary world.
Well, I mean, I'm shocked before proud, I think, because so much. Also, there were so few precedents before writers like me. I mean, they were wonderful, like Julio Alvarez and Sandra Cisneros and others who come. So, it's everything one does. It's like it's been like forging a path in a way. And one of the things that's been really comforting, that's been really, that I'm most proud of, is that the work that I've done has gone beyond the book. And I think that's what ties in also within with this story, you know, with this book, is that it just takes the story outside of the pages, because there are a lot of families like mine. There are a lot of kids like mine, like me, stories like mine, and that I would say the difference between me and someone else in the same circumstances that I grew up is opportunity. And I've been, you know, blessed to have had these opportunities through the work, you said, the sacrifices of my parents and the support that I've had throughout my life. So I feel as though everything that I've written is a celebration of that and acknowledgement of that.
One of your books was an Oprah Book Club selection. There's quite a home run, my gosh.
Actually, that was my first novel, Breath Eyes Memory. It wasn't picked right after publication. It was a couple of years after, but it's
still.
That's not diminishing at all. It's just to clarify, because I was 25 when that book came out, and probably that would have messed with my head big time if it had happened so early. But that was huge, and I think that brought in some readers that are still with me today, because that book was published with a very small press, and that selection really grew an audience for Breath Eyes Memory, which is the book, and which I think is has stayed with me throughout the other books.
You know, when I was promoting this program, I had a dilemma. Do I say you're a Haitian American author or an acclaimed award-winning author? And I went with the latter. And I said, but then it's such an important part of who you are that you are Haitian American. How do you prefer to be seen?
Well, as Haitian as possible.
Okay.
Haitian American. So Haitian American is fine. And again, because I think it's just so important for us to see ourselves reflected in other people, the possibilities for ourselves. And there's so many negative stereotypes that are presented about Haitians and Haitian Americans. So I think the more of us that are out there proclaiming who we are, the better overall it is. And the fact is that I have spent more of my life here than I have in Haiti. So Haitian American, I think, accurately describes who.
I read this piece you wrote in The New Yorker from February 25th. Do you remember that? It's drawn from this new introduction or this new edition of Go Tell It on the Mountain by James Baldwin. I just read it. Was he an inspiration in your life?
Oh, absolutely. James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou were very important writers to me, writers of the American scene. James Baldwin was especially important because he did a lot of what I try to do, sort of in the range of what I try to do, because I do nonfiction, I do these essays, and his essays, you know, have always been a model for me. But Go Tell It on the Mountain was a very, the book that I wrote the introduction for, it's the 50th anniversary.
Okay.
Not the 50th, I mean, it was 100 year, he would be 100 years, I think, this year. And so it's a very powerful, it's a first novel. It's one of those books that I go back to over and over.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And do you see, what are your feelings about his hypothetical country?
Well, he gave this, what I draw the this hypothetical country notion from is that he gave this talk at San Francisco State College in which he talks about, he says, let's pretend that I'm writing a book. And then when you are listening to the talk, it's online, or if you read in one of his book of essays, you realize that he's like describing this country that would be better for their children than it was for their parents, and all of the things that he was dealing with we're dealing with today very sadly. I mean, that talk was in the 1960s with police brutality and inequalities and income inequality and lack of opportunities. And I think for a lot of us who come here as immigrants, there's a tendency sometimes to sort of try to exclude ourselves from that struggle. And then we are part of the struggle, you know. It's like we're here. I can do these things. I can, because someone marched ultimately, you know, and I was able to come and enjoy the fruits of that labor. So that the way I've always felt sort of like our struggles are married to the struggles of this country that he's trying to make. And we're in an election year where we're being sold all kinds of goods.
Are you political? You know? Are you politically active? Or is it just through your writing that you?
Well, I try to be a part of an active citizenry. You know, I try to engage in issues that are important to me, that I believe where my voice is needed. You know,
Lizette, we want to just talk about some of the events that are going on during the big read. We know that. Edwige will be at the Little Haiti Cultural Center on the 31st, 6:30 p.m. on Thursday the 31st, in conversation with attorney Cheryl Little. But you want to highlight some of the other events briefly?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, so tomorrow evening, also in the Little Haiti Cultural Center in the Caribbean Marketplace, there is going to open an exhibition of photography by a couple of photographers that are Haitian Americans, such as Carl Joust, who with the Miami Herald, and Whistler Dulles Fort, who is a documentary street photographer. He's been doing a lot of work to document the community, who lives in Little Haiti and the larger Haitian American community, not just in Little Haiti, but in other parts of South Florida. And some students, the work of some students at Miami-Dade College who have been learning alongside Carl by documenting their communities, and not also Little Haiti, but in Little Havana as well. That's there's going to be a little bit of a party and reception tomorrow night, and we invite everyone to come out. That should be a lot of fun, but also to the point that that Edwige is making about showing the true face of our communities, the people who live in our communities and who they are, and kind of dispel those stereotypes. That's a little bit of what we're doing with this photography exhibition.
Lisa, I don't want to interrupt you, but unfortunately, we just have about 3 minutes left. I wish we had the whole hour, but we don't.
Definitely.
So if we can just give the website, it's neabigread.org or the
All the programs are up at miamibookfair.com.
Okay. So, yeah. Miamibookfair.com or NEA. Or neabigread.org, correct?
Yes, but the miamibookfair.com is probably the easiest to be able to find all the different programs that we're doing in Miami.
Okay. So tell us about, you're in a movie on Saturday, March 12th, Edwige. It's called at O Cinema, 1 to 3 p.m. on Saturday, March 12th, Stones in the Sun.
Stones in the Sun. So Stones in the Sun is a movie that was directed by a Haitian American woman, Patricia Benoit. I have a role in the movie. I'm actually acting in it, and it'll be shown this Saturday. And I think it tells also a very interesting story about people who come here. It's three different families and a couple, a mother, father and son, and how they cope with immigrant life. It'll be fascinating. You get to see.
And what was your role in it?
I play one of two sisters who are very sort of very opposed in their ways of life. One is the other sister, the glamorous sister, is a realtor who sells like high-end real estate in Long Island, New York, and I'm the academic. I'm like the one that gets on her nerves.
And when you're talking to Cheryl Little, attorney Cheryl Little, on the 31st, what is that about?
Well, Cheryl Little from American for Immigrant Justice was extraordinarily crucial, her work to my uncle's case and in getting documents that allowed the writing of this book. So it will be first a continuous expression of my gratitude for American for Immigrant Justice and to Cheryl and others who helped with my uncle's case. And we'll have a conversation that's literary, I suppose, but also very much to the nitty-gritty of what families go through when they're going to the situation that I did when I found my uncle was in Kroom Detention Center, dying.
After he'd been arrested.
Yes.
Well, you can find out more about that in, of course, Brother, I'm Dying. I see that 2 years ago you received an honorary degree from Brooklyn College. Mm-hmm. If you wouldn't mind, would you read what you said there?
Oh. Be brave in spirit, be brave in mind. Because only those with imagination and courage are able to reach beyond the ordinary and take us to the next frontier. Be brave, too, in not being afraid to fail, because there will be plenty of missteps on your way to getting where you want to go from this place. Don't look for adversity, but you may not fully appreciate your blessings if things always go well. Be brave of heart, be brave in love, be brave in your openness, your patience and tolerance, your empathy and compassion, too. Be brave one step, one action. One decision at a time. Be brave in private, be brave in public, and try to be brave consistently.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. That is the quest of my life.
Well, you're doing a good job. So Edwige Janticat, her book, her memoir, her weemoir, Brother, I'm Dying, has been chosen by Lizette Mendez for the Big Read Miami. You can get all the information about the Big Read Miami at miamibookfair.com. Edwige Janticat, it's been a pleasure. You'll have to come back sometime.
It's been so wonderful. Thank you very much. Thank you both for having me.
Thank you.
Lizette Mendez, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's really my pleasure.
Thank you.
Food and Dining up next.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Think of how much time one may spend in a supermarket. Sure, some of you might never push a cart through a lane or make use of coupons, but others spend lots of money and certainly energy shopping for food. So as usual, chef, author, syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer is with us, and this week we navigate today's modern supermarkets. Hey, Linda.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, Linda.
Nice to be with you. You know, Joe and Bonnie, organic. So what's the scoop? You know, grocery aisles are filled with organic foods. And I wanted to know, what does organic really mean? What does 100% organic mean? What are we buying? And our guest today is going to help us out. He's television and radio reporter. He's a consumer trend watcher. He's Phil Lampert. And he's the editor of his popular and very informative website, supermarketguru.com. Welcome, Phil Lampert.
Thank you, Linda. It's always great to be with you.
Always. I'm looking forward to what you have to tell us. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions or comments about organic food? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Or radio at WLRN.org.
And of course, with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. And Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column that you can read in the Miami Herald or online. And you can also read Fred's wine column in Saturday's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
I'm going to talk about wines that have flavors added to them to be a little more sweet or something like that.
Oh, that sounds good.
If you like it.
Okay. Phil Lampert, organic. Tell us, what does the label mean? One's a circle that says USDA certified. Another says 100%. What's this all about?
Well, Linda, it's more complicated than the average person thinks. Let's start off with the most important thing, that from a nutrition standpoint, USDA certified organic or conventional is the same nutritionally. And there's been a lot of studies.
That's very interesting to note, that no matter what, by conventional you mean the regular produce that we buy.
Correct.
Yes.
Now, when you see that seal, USDA certified organic, that means that there has been very strict rules that have been followed, that the government has set up. There are also other certification agencies like QAI and so on. So whenever you see that seal, you'll know that you're buying organic. Now, organic doesn't mean no pesticides. In fact, there's actually over 100 different pesticides that can be used in organic production.
Let's see, hear that again. You can use organic foods can have pesticides in them. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
So one of the most important things whenever you buy any produce is to make sure that you're washing it. And probably a produce wash is the best thing. My favorite one is actually FIT, F-I-T, which is actually made from citrus. So it really cleans it. There's no soap in it and so on. And you're really getting a thorough washing of those fruits and vegetables.
Well, that's
the other thing.
I just ask you about that? Because I always wondered. Let's say I'm eating an apple, and it's an organic one, but it's had pesticides. Does it mean that it's never had any pesticides inside? In other words, I guess I should ask it this way. If it's a conventional apple and it's had pesticides, I wash the outside. But as it's growing, would there be any pesticides residue inside?
Well, keep in mind that the way that you get pesticides or bacteria inside any fruit or vegetable is the fact that most people have not washed it. You're taking a knife, you're cutting through it, so that knife blade is actually putting whatever the residue is on the outside into the inside. And while pesticides are one element of it, the other thing we've got to remember is that organic production allows for manure to be used as a fertilizer. And one of the reasons that we constantly keep on seeing more E. coli outbreaks on organic produce is exactly the fact that E. coli comes from manure. So we've really got to be smart on what we're buying, you know, get the triple washed lettuces, if you would, that are in the bags. Yes, it has a slight chlorine bath to it, but it's not harmful. And we really want to protect ourselves not only against pesticide residue, but also a lot of pathogens and a lot of bacteria.
Phil, I have the feeling that a lot of people are maybe like me in that we just kind of ignore that and just open up the grape bag and eat a few.
Correct, which is the wrong thing to do. Absolutely.
Well, that's not a first.
And I just want to say one other thing. One of the biggest movements that we've seen, and we're just talking about produce right now, is the movement towards local. Now, local is, in my opinion, better than organic. The reason is that when you're buying local produce and you've got retailers like Publix that has long been a proponent of buying local, buying Florida-grown, which is very important, that produce has actually either been on the vine or in the ground or on a tree longer. It didn't have to be shipped from Peru or Chile or other products, which means that it does have more flavor and it has more nutrients, again, because it was on the stem longer than being picked before it was ripe and then possibly gassed. Now, you talk about apples, Linda, and the thing that most people don't realize, I don't care what kind of apple it is, most apples are in storage, cold storage, for about a year before it hits, you know, your supermarket. So you really, if you love apples, you want to talk to your produce manager, you want to find out what are the freshest apples possible. And again, you're going to get a lot different flavor, a lot different taste sensation from a freshly picked apple than one that's been in cold storage for a year.
Wow. Well, let me ask you something else that that's kind of been wondering about. You know, we have Walmart, we have Costco, we have so many supermarkets. They're all selling organic produce, and I don't think we grow that much organic produce in the United States. So what are we buying? Where is it coming from?
Well, you're correct, Linda.
I'm sad to hear that I'm correct.
Yeah, I know. And unfortunately, there's two things to remember. The best growing regions are in Mexico, used to be in California before the drought. For citrus, certainly Florida, but now with the whole greening situation, a lot of those crops have been destroyed. The citrus in Florida is down to about a third of what it was before the greening disease hit. So a lot of it's coming from Mexico, Peru, Chile, and keep in mind that their regulations for organic might not be the same as ours. That's number one. Number two is one of the biggest producers of produce, and Linda, I hope you're sitting down, that export to the U.S. is actually from China. So a lot of that's going into food service operations. We've got to read the labels carefully.
Well, sorry to interrupt you, Phil. Yeah. You know, read the labels carefully. There are a lot of sad faces in this room when you said that about China. And what do we look for on a label? It's hard.
It's hard, and it's getting even worse. The reason it's worse is part of the Farm Bill. At the last minute, what happened is they actually deregulated country of origin labeling. So for a period of time, whether it was seafood, whether it was produce, whatever, by law, it had to say on that package which country it came from. That law has now been repealed. So we don't have that. So we've really got to rely on looking at the boxes That sometimes we don't see, but in the produce department, sometimes they'll actually put the box in the case, look at it carefully, and ask your produce manager where it's coming from. Unfortunately, this was one of those shockers that for so many years really helped consumers, and then to repeal it, and they repealed it basically because they had complaints from other countries, because we don't want to buy our food from China. We might not want to buy our foods from Mexico and the like, and now we just don't know where it's coming from without really doing some investigation.
Well, now we can't say that because it comes from Mexico or because it comes from China, it's necessarily bad. What controls are there? What U.S. controls are there for this food that's imported?
There is inspections that take place on our borders. However, according to USDA, that's less than 1% of all food that is imported into the U.S. is actually inspected. So we don't have a great checks and balances in there. And I've been to China, and I've been to a lot of food factories in China, and I can tell you that personally, I avoid buying products, products from China. Mexico has some great farming, as does Peru and Chile, and it really depends on farm after farm after farm.
Well, let me ask you then, having heard all of this, is it worth buying organic foods? I mean, it's an extra cost. I mean, should we be buying it?
It depends on why you're buying it. One of the important regulations about being USDA certified organic is that it cannot contain GMOs. It cannot have any genetically modified organisms in that product. So, you know, as we're seeing this battle playing out for labeling of GMOs and everybody's spending hundreds of millions of dollars to fight it, all you've got to do if you want to avoid GMOs is buy certified organic. So if you're looking to do that, yes, certified organic is good. There's certain produce items that have a thick skin, if you would, like a banana. I would never buy an organic banana. As I said before, for me, buying local is far better than buying organic, both for the flavor and the nutrients. If you've got something that's very porous, like a raspberry, for example, I would buy, you know, organic raspberries. But if it's got a thick skin on it, probably no reason to spend that extra money.
Okay.
And when we look at a lot of the products that are out there that are in jars and boxes that are organic, again, you've got to figure out
why potatoes.
There are very few organic potatoes actually grown here in the U.S. And I think that when you buy a potato, the most important thing we've got to remember is that it has been in the ground. Make sure you have a really stiff potato brush and really scrub it, because, you know, a lot of people don't scrub their potatoes the way they should. The reason is that really is dirt, and it could have different fertilizer or different pesticides as part of it. So you want to be real careful.
I think we're going to be scrubbing our fruits, vegetables.
Yes,
yep.
But we're going to have to take a short break here. This is fascinating. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking about organic food with supermarket guru Phil Lempert. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. And we've been talking about the realities, or maybe the myths, of buying organic food with supermarket guru Phil Lempert. He's a television and radio reporter. He's a consumer trend watcher. And he has this very popular and very informative website. It's called supermarketguru.com. And he's been giving us so much fascinating information. If you've missed some of it, it'll be archived at WLRN.org.
Bonnie's afraid to eat her own cooking now.
Now, yeah. Maybe she was afraid before that. Never mind.
Maybe there isn't any.
Okay. Well, now it's dinner in a minute's time. So if you're still going to be cooking, the dinner today is horseradish encrusted chicken with garlic, sweet potatoes, and sugar snap peas. Most chicken we use is boneless, skinless chicken breast, but I like the thighs because they have so much more flavor and they're juicy. And here, the horseradish gives it a lot of zip. And the potatoes and snap peas take only minutes because I make them in the microwave. So all you have to do is you mix the mayonnaise and horseradish together and you coat the chicken with it. Roll the chicken in some panko breadcrumbs, cook it in the skillets about 5 minutes each side. A meat thermometer should
read
165 minutes. Yes, you can olive oil, or you can just spray your pan. But
not butter.
You could use, I knew you wanted to use the butter. Go ahead, enjoy yourself. For this, you know, all my columns fit the government guidelines for nutrition, but never mind. The side dish, you cut the potatoes in about the same size as your snap peas, and you want to really wash them really well. Right, Phil?
Yes, okay, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And wash the chicken breast also. And when you're buying chicken, you know, always look at that package when you're buying fresh chicken, and you'll see a little bladder underneath the chicken. That absorbs whatever extra moisture. Usually the more moist that the chicken breast is, the longer it's been sitting in that case. So gently press down on the chicken breast and see how much moisture is coming out of that bladder, whether or not the juices are running clear, whether or not there's some blood spots in it, and that's the way they can make sure you get the freshest chicken breast possible.
So you don't want the blood spots?
No.
No.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's great advice. Thank you. Well, that recipe is from my book, Quick and Easy Chicken, and you can also read that complete recipe with a photo. It's at dinnerinminutes.com. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
Linda, last week I talked about the idea that every new generation of wine drinkers has its own entry wine. The first wine they try from Boone's Farm or in the 70s to sweet red wines for today's millennial generation. And it turns out now that it's a bigger trend than I even realized. These days, it isn't enough to just make good wine. Now you've got to have a gimmick. It's kind of like cloning human beings. We can probably do it, but is it a good idea? Now, flavored wines aren't new. The ancient Greeks added herbs to their wine, and they even smoked it to cover up the fact that they hadn't invented corks yet, so the wine was usually spoiled. But now we have chocolate wine.
That sounds good. Yeah, I think that sounds good, chocolate wine.
Actually, it does taste pretty good. I'm a little embarrassed to say it, but it does. For $11 a bottle, you can buy Choco Vine, whose slogan is the taste of Dutch chocolate and fine red wine. It's French Cabernet with Dutch chocolate added, and its sales are booming. And I found that it goes pretty well with chocolate chip cookies. And then in France, the Haussmann Famille Chateau is making white wine flavored with grapefruit and red wine flavored with cola. And that makes sense because during the Beijing Olympics, American reporters reported that rich but clueless Chinese drinkers felt that even the top expensive French Bordeaux wines were too dry for them. So this cut them 50% with Coca-Cola.
Oh, what a crime.
And of course, it's not just wine. Vodka comes in a dozen flavors now, from cherry to whipped cream. And in my liquor cabinet, speaking of organic, I have a bottle of organic cucumber vodka, which makes a pretty good martini, actually. And you can also buy several brands of pineapple-flavored whiskey. And Captain Morgan makes a pineapple-flavored rum. I guess it's too much trouble to go out and buy regular rum to add to your own and add your own pineapple juice. And finally, the drinks bloggers in the Huffington Post report that winemakers are looking into that ultimate adulterated flavor, proving that the apocalypse is near. They're making wine flavored with salty, smoky bacon.
That would be up your alley, Joe. Yeah, Joe.
I think that's even too much for me.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Phil Lampert, what about that organic cucumber vodka?
Sure. You know, here's the problem. That what people have found out is that when you put the name organic on anything, sales go up. So, for example, Whole Foods got caught a few years ago by having organic salmon. Well, there is no regulation for organic seafood because you really can't track fish, but they were selling it, I think at the time, for like $27.99 a pound.
Wow.
Same thing, yeah, same thing that we're seeing with, you know, organic beers or organic vodkas and so on. And back to what was talked about before, about organic potatoes, one of the reasons that we really don't see a lot of organic potatoes is the cost to produce them is through the roof. So when you have an organic cucumber vodka that you're going to find that it's probably very, very expensive. Now, you can also have grain-based vodkas, but those are probably not going to be organic because, again, you know, a lot of grains are GMOs. So, again, it's what you really want to see with that label.
Okay, so is there any regulation? If I wanted to, if they're calling it organic vodka, organic cucumber vodka, and it really isn't, is there any regulation, government regulation against, I mean, can anybody just put organic on a label?
Unfortunately, the way the system works with the government as far as labeling goes, you and I could come up with any product we want. We could put on it gluten-free, paleo, organic, whatever. And until somebody actually complains, registers a complaint with the government and has proof that we are cheating, that our ingredients are not, nothing happens. So again, we really don't have a great checks and balances system. And when you look at every year, there's about 16,000 new food and beverage products that are introduced, and a supermarket has about 50,000 products. It's really a monumental task that the government is faced with.
Wow. And then again, we only have about 30 seconds left, but, you know, when you're looking at processed foods and condiments and things and they say they're organic, that doesn't mean that every single ingredient in that bottle is.
If it has a USDA certified seal on it, that means that it has 95% or greater organic ingredients. Otherwise, they can't use that seal, and they would just have to list the ingredients that it has organic whatever. The reason for that is there are certain products, for example, that have a lot of water in them. There is no such thing as organic water. So, you know, that's why the government regulation is like that.
Wow. There's so many more questions to ask you, but we're just out of time. Wonderful advice, as always, Phil Lampert. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
His website is supermarketguru.com. Can anyone go to that website?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. And Bonnie Berman, Joe Cooper.
Yeah.
Are you going to be cooking these days, Bonnie?
Well, the baked potatoes I cook are going to be scrubbed so much there may not be any potato left.
Okay. Fred Tasker, thanks for your great advice.
Always a pleasure.
Well, next week we'll be talking with megastar Martha Stewart. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Our Big Read segment was produced by Polly Landis. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Richard Ives is lead producer. Remember, we always invite you to listen again via the WLRN website. Free audio archives for download. Also, more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Linda, remember when Martha Stewart asked me if I'd fixed dinner for her? A bit daunting, huh?
Did you?
No. Topical Currents takes a brief hiatus on Monday and Tuesday of next week. Our studio is in use for the live national broadcast of Here and Now and its coverage of the Florida presidential primary. We hope you'll tune in for that.
It's going to be exciting. Quite a week.
Florida primary.
Yep.
After that, we'll return Wednesday to interview longtime South Florida icon Ruth Shack.
I remember pitching with Ruth Shack on fund drives years ago.
No, we don't use that word pitching anymore.
Oh, I mean fundraising.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer, Fred Tasker, thanks for listening. Here and Now is up next from NPR News.